You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 491.
Hello and welcome back to The Outdoor Station. I'm your host, Bob Cartwright, and The Outdoor Station has been producing audio and video podcasts for the self-powered traveller since way back in 2005. With a library of almost 500 podcasts and 100 videos, we speak to outdoors folk with stories to tell. Plus, of course, we get outdoors ourselves. Anything, in fact, to inspire people to enjoy a healthy outdoors lifestyle and appreciate the world around us along the way. As I get ever closer to podcast number 500, I feel there's a moment coming to make some changes to the free content and add something new to our output. And this podcast is exactly that. Because it's a 30-minute audio extract from my first hour-long video interview with Katie Jane Endurance regarding her 600-kilometre south-to-north traverse of Iceland in June-July 2019. You may remember in podcast number 486 that Dermot Cosgrove passed Katie coming the opposite way on his traverse, which unfortunately didn't quite go to plan. Following his comments, I tracked her down to Switzerland and found she's an endurance athlete with a very interesting outdoor CV. Of course, you can find all the links to Katie and the full video interview over on the show notes and on our YouTube channel. But please, don't forget to subscribe while you're there. I think Iceland holds a significant curiosity for all outdoors people due to its unique landscape and location. In the video interview, you'll see various animated maps of Katie's route. We zoom into the detail using Google Earth, and Katie talks us through photos from each day of her journey. And that's Katie Jane Endurance, and welcome to the show, Katie. Lovely to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have a great experience and of doing a whole variety of endurance events, etc. But Iceland is something different for you. So how did Iceland come about?
Iceland came about because of a failed trip earlier this year, back in January. I ended up on a trip that I didn't really want to be on, doing something I didn't really want to do, which I didn't know till I got there. And I had basically set off on a 7 month journey to try and be the first person in the world to run across Europe. And after 6 days, I did the thing I've never done before, and that was quit. And kind of completely thrown me. I've never quitted on an expedition before. And yeah, got home and kind of had to really ask myself some big questions. Why on earth had I ended up where I was? You know, running down hard shoulders of dual carriageways on the Costa del Sol is a far cry from what really makes me tick. You know, I'm passionate about wild and remote places. So how did I end up on this trip? And yeah, I had to really figure things out. And by the end of figuring those things out, I just realized I needed just to go somewhere wild and be sure that I still really love it. Adventures. And it was just a blip, and it wasn't, you know, something telling me that this part of my life was over. And so I also at that point decided to do some qualifications, which I'm currently doing, will take a couple of years, but that was eating into my time and my budget. So I needed to go somewhere really wild and remote, but on a kind of, that wasn't too far away. I couldn't kind of go to far-flung places of the world, and it needed to kind of be a cheap short plane ride away. And I remember a good friend of mine, Al Humphreys, had said to me that Iceland was actually his favourite journey of all. Yeah, that's not too far away, and that's not too expensive a plane ride. And I looked into the middle of it, and it looks pretty wild and remote. So yeah, that's kind of how it came about. It really just ticked the boxes of what I was looking for. And I just wanted to go somewhere that was just a simple adventure for the pure pleasure of going on an adventure. No records, no world first, no racing people. I just wanted to go somewhere where I could just, me and my backpack, and look after myself on a primal level, you know, food, water, shelter, that kind of thing. That's what I love. And I just, yeah, wanted to get back to that. And Iceland was the place to go.
Well, that's a good start. But this isn't the normal type of adventures or endurance races that you're known for, is it?
Yeah, a lot of my other trips have been more kind of inadvertently ended up as a first, or, you know, I'm racing other people against the clock, or I'm trying to do a fast time. Yeah, they've always been a bit more about struggle, challenge, adversity, whereas Iceland definitely could be like that and throws in a few elements like that. But it was more just about the wilderness and just an adventure rather than putting myself through suffering and pain, which is what I normally do.
On your sort of experience there, the one that sort of fascinates me most of all, and we saw a bit in the video clip, was the Great Wall of China walk. I hadn't realised, or I assumed, because that's the only picture you ever see really, is the wall had been maintained for its full length. But obviously walking its full length as you did, it was quite a different experience.
I too had thought the wall was going to be maintained when I came up with the idea of walking the Great Wall of China. I'd seen these, you know, it was on my bucket list. You'd seen photos of, you know, wonders of the world, and I'd wanted to go and see it. And so I'd actually met a man, and one of his chat up line was to ask me to walk to him to the North Pole. He was a polar explorer, and obviously I don't know what on earth would I work for, but over several months he convinced me that this was a really good thing. I really wanted to walk to the North Pole and I should join him, and I eventually agreed, but I said, you know, maybe I should try something easier to start, because obviously this adventure world was completely new to me. And so at that point I suggested, why don't we walk the Great Wall of China? I honestly thought it would be, you know, a few weeks. I had no idea it was going to take 6 months, be 4,500 because let alone no one had done the full west to east crossing. The picture that I had imagined would go and walk along, you know, that postcard picture of the wall, actually makes up maybe 1% of my journey. Most of it was either dead or mountains, and I probably only saw a wall of sorts for even 30% of the journey. And a lot of the time, unless you had a map actually showing you that it was, you know, the wall, you just think it was a mound of gravel or something. So yeah, very different to what I expected, but utterly life-changing. I mean, I've been very fortunate to have gone to so many parts of the world, but nothing compares to walking across the Great Wall of China. Probably because it was my first, it was, you know, as cliche as it sounds, it was life-changing. I cried pretty much every day and became a different person at the end of it. So the people were incredible, the sights were incredible, the hardship was unbelievable, but I wouldn't change it for the world. It was the best thing I've ever done.
if anybody ever wants to read more detail about it, of course they can look over on your website, where you've got full stories on your blog there of some of the adventures that you've done, which makes for fascinating reading. I've been going through their cyber stalking you naturally, as one would do in a situation like this. Ready for the interview. Now, but of course, the reason we're here tonight is to talk about the Iceland trip. Fascinating. And you became known to me via Dermot, who obviously you bumped into on, I presume it must have been your last day and his first. So I'm curious to know how your experience was and how it differed to him, certainly.
Poor Dermot. When I saw those pictures of his feet after just 2 days, I really still can't quite get over how they got so bad so quickly. I did suffer from a few feet problems along the way. I think his were due to the tarmac. For me, I suffered in the desert. The volcanic ash is incredibly sharp. It might look like a kind of grain of sand when you get little bits in your boots, but they're little knives. And I actually had lots of cuts all over the bottom of my feet and between my toes and things, mainly from crossing rivers. And you try and dry your feet the best you can, but the grit still gets in. So yeah, I did suffer for some sore feet, but not blisters in the way he did. So when I saw the pictures after I'd met him, I was, poor guy, but he'll be back next year, I'm sure, to finish the job. But yeah, I saw him on my second to last day, actually. But overall, I had just a fantastic journey. It was such a treat to go on a journey where I wasn't crying all the time and actually had a lovely time. It sounds crazy when you do adventures. You'd think it would all be fun, but it's type 2 fun, I generally do, which means it's fun after it's finished. But Iceland was type 1 fun most of the time, which was a real pleasure. I think I had gone expecting it to be harder than it was. Not saying it was easy, but I think my expectations were the rivers were going to be worse. I mean, the weather in Iceland is not great. You know, it's notoriously very, very windy and rainy, but I think I had a good run of weather for Iceland standards. So it just went generally well. I don't have any near-death experiences, which makes a nice change, but doesn't make for such a good story, but it's a nice change for me. And I just had a lovely time. I generally haven't done many trips solo, and this one was solo, so I really relished the opportunity to do it on my own. And for 5 days, I didn't see a living thing, not even a bird, let alone a person to talk to. So yeah, really, really loved it. Couldn't recommend it highly enough. And the other great thing we can talk in more detail about, but I think if someone's looking for a remote and wild adventure, particularly if they're going solo, but perhaps are a little bit nervous, I think Iceland's a really safe place to go. Obviously, you've still got to look after yourself and the environment against the elements, but got an amazing search and rescue team that were watching over me. Yeah, I just think it was a really good place to go and do a solo journey.
I was fascinated reading your blog post and your diary about it. Although there wasn't many people you met, but there was actually, it was interesting, the number of people you met, and obviously they all spoke English. Were they Icelandic people, or were they Americans or tourists or what?
The people doing the traverse?
Yeah.
Yeah, not Icelandic. Whenever I met Icelandic people, they were completely flabbergasted by walking across the country. I'm sure some people have, but it didn't sound like many walk across the country. So I met, Americans, Spanish, French, Italians. Yeah, a real mixture going down. That makes it sound like there were lots. There weren't that many. I probably met six people heading similar route to me, but north to south, and I was obviously going south to north. I think from my research, when I was researching the trip, there are a number of blogs out there which give, you know, lots of insightful information, lots of pictures and videos, which you can kind of really gather, you know, an impression of the place you're going to and help you choose your route. But there weren't that many blogs. So when I got out there and met, you know, six or so people, that was more expected, considering, you know, people could have started later or I could have missed them somehow. So yeah, I think it's a trip that is done more than I anticipated. It's not an actual route. It's not like the PCT or Appalachia Trail where there's a designed route, but it is something that seemingly every year, a good handful to 10 people perhaps are doing it in one way or another.
So how difficult is it to get to the your start point in the south there?
Nice and easy. So it's probably something to add here. So I didn't meet anyone else, and I haven't read about anyone else going from south to north. Everyone else goes north to south. The reason why I went the opposite way was actually because there is a section quite early on, my day 3 and 4, which is a famous trail in Iceland, and I knew it was going to get busy come July, so I wanted to get it done in June. I wanted to feel kind of as if I was in the wild and didn't want to see too many people. That was the only reason really I went from south to north, but it wasn't till I got to my finish line that I realized why everybody else goes north to south, and that is it is a lot easier to get. If you were finishing in the south, you're right there in public transport, there's a town, it's just much easier. So you finished your trip, you're tired, you've had enough, and you can kind of get back to the city or you can get some accommodation. And that makes perfect sense, and that'll be why everyone else did it that way around. Whereas when you finish at the northernmost point of the island, there's nothing there, there is no public transport for at least 200 kilometres. And I was very lucky, I only walked about 15K before I was able to hitch a ride. But it could have been days. So, unless you have a particular preference, north to south would probably be easier just from a logistics at the end point of view. But also at my start, I did originally plan to start at the true southernmost point, which is just a bit of black sand. But a film crew and some very evil birds prevented that. normally, I'd have been like freaking out and cross that my kind of detailed planning was going to pot. But on this particular trip, again, because I had no agenda, there was no kind of racing anyone or anything else. I just thought, okay, I will walk 25K to a new start point, which is the Southern Nemo's building, which is a lighthouse right on, you know, it's a few meters different in, you know, distance down, but yeah, it wasn't officially the lowest point of the island, but on this instant, I didn't mind. I thought, okay, I want to start, you know, somewhere official. So the lighthouse seemed good. So I walked there. Pretty much everyone else finishes their journey anyway. So it worked out fine. But it took me two goes to start.
You're listening to the outdoorsstation.co.uk.
Bringing you more about the outdoors world.
Podcast is a story around self-powered travel. If you walk, run, cycle, paddle, climb, explore, or sail, we want to share your adventure, hear your highs and lows, and inspire others to go out and do more.
Well, I understood that there was some filming going on and where you're initially intending to start, which was a bit frustrating, I'm sure. But just to continue what you were saying about the actual where you finished, you obviously hadn't sort of researched or planned public transport from that point. But how did the people who started in North get there?
So they would have organised some form of taxi or drop-off service, whether it by friend or you know, paying somebody, but they would have actually organized some form of a lift, paid them and got dropped off at the actual start point, which is easier to do pre-expedition than when you're tired and afterwards.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's actually look at the map and the route now and start us off, as it were. I wonder if I can just drop the little man down here. Well, as close as he gets is here, just to see what you were faced with. I've had a quick look at this, and it looks like the first day really was a lot of this type of road walking.
So I was faced with a complete whiteout, so I didn't get the spectacular views at the start. I'm probably seeing, I'm seeing more now on Google Earth than I saw in person. That's brilliant, isn't it? I actually ended up walking 50K on my first day, because I actually had to walk to get to the lighthouse as well. But it was dull. It was road walking. I was passing a million tourists doing, you know, their Iceland by vehicle. By midday, it was torrential rain, howling gales. And I was pretty unhappy, I have to say. It wasn't, you know, it when you've come here to kind of resurrect your love for adventure after a disastrous adventure early in the year, it wasn't the first day that I'd hoped, and I was longing, you know, for it to be over and I could get in my tent. But by the time I got to where I was camping, you know, my everything was wet when I was setting up the tent, everything going in the tent was wet, and it was just a bit of a soggy start. But it got a whole lot better the next day, so I can't complain. It was just, I just had to get that road section out the way, and I knew it was going to be there, and I knew it was only going to get far more wild and beautiful from there on in.
Well, we've got a few pictures that we'll just run through while you're talking and set the scene, but as people can probably see straight away, it was a bit misty. But
apparently there's lots of lovely puffins at the start, but I didn't get to see them, sadly.
So that's another question, actually. The birds, obviously Dermot had a bit of a issue with terns, I think he said it was, and you had a different bird that attacked you, is that right?
So at the start, well, my original start, I got attacked by, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I'm sure, but skua birds. They are massive, very, very big, strong built, kind of eagle-sized bird. They nest on the sand, it's not like any birds were above my head. And before I knew it, they were just coming at head height, and they just they're notorious for just attacking your head until you sprint away. But they're big enough that they're definitely quite frightening. And I had the film crew chasing me in a vehicle and the birds chasing me. I thought, it's not worth it. I'll start somewhere else. It's just an adventure. So I had those birds, and then I was attacked quite a lot by the terns up in the north. But Dermot had warned me about those. So I walked along with my poles above my head for many, many kilometres getting arm ache, but it was better than getting pecked.
So that was your first day, this route here. So I'm just trying to compare it to the Google Earth, and I think it's looks like you went to the Skoggafoss waterfall. Was that sort of area where you camped the first night?
Yeah, I camped right next to the waterfall. It was marvelous.
Let's see if we can see if we got a picture of it. See what it looks like in the better weather. How did you find the camping? Obviously, we'll get into it a bit more.
Yeah. So for the first three nights, I stayed in designated camping areas because it's national park and you don't have any choice. So that actually kind of determined the mileage I could cover as well, because I knew, you know, I had a few options to stay, but yeah, I couldn't truly wild camp, albeit they're not hugely luxurious campsites in the national park anyway. So it's kind of wild camping with others.
Looking at the camping there, I assumed probably, and I don't know if you did when you knew before you started, that it would be fairly open to wild camping, but are they pretty strict on it?
I don't believe wild camping is necessarily, I don't know the legalities, but I think I've read you're not supposed to wild camp anywhere in Iceland officially, because the moss and the grasses are so protected because they're just getting eroded. So they definitely try and keep everyone together, particularly in touristy parts. Out in the highlands, kind of from day five onwards, I mean, you would be allowed because there is nothing else there, but probably a bit like France, you know, it's the kind of place where you just set up, you know, end of days and leave early in the day and not hinder anybody's kind of view and things like that, then I'm sure it's fine. But I don't think it's a kind of, it's not like Scotland where you're kind of free to camp where you like, but people do. I think particularly Iceland is massive for camper vans and people camping in vans. So I think when they say no camping, they're probably who they're targeting, because there are so many people traveling in vehicles. Actually, if they all could stop wherever they wanted, there would be vehicles everywhere. There are less people wandering around with their little tents on their back, so I don't think they mind us too much.
You mentioned the safety service, the safe travel system, sort of kept an eye on you. I'm just going to have a quick look at that now. Could you talk a bit about that, if you would?
Yeah, it's a fantastic service, and I really stumbled across it. I'm thrilled that I did, but it definitely didn't come, it wasn't as apparent as I kind of expected it to be for something so great. But it's obviously run by the Search and Rescue Services, but what it is it's an informational website, so you can go on and you can see whether there's any hazards or warnings or road closures or anything problematic. Obviously, a lot of it is designed for people doing expeditions on vehicles, especially in the winter. You know, they're forever trying to get stuck vehicles out of places. But they have this great feature where you attach your travel plan. It's quite detailed. You put in every day where you expect to be, on what day, how long you're going to be there, that kind of thing. And then you send it in and they kind of acknowledge that they've got it. So you put all the data in, and then basically the services they're watching you. They know where you're going to be, and if you haven't got there, you know, for several days, then they're going to come looking for you. So it's great to know that kind of someone's looking out for you. They also have a little app that you put on your phone, and with pressing a button once a day, that kind of gives them your GPS coordinates. So it's another way to tell them that you are where you said you were going to be. So I think it's fantastic. I've never come across another country with something like this. Maybe they do exist, but good on Iceland if not, because I think it gives you a peace of mind. Obviously, I didn't need it, but I'm sure there are people out there that might end up needing it. So yeah.
Well, yeah, the different road conditions. And how did you find it? Did you just stumble across it?
Literally stumbled across it, and I thanked them. You know, I sent an email actually afterwards thanking them, saying this is a really lovely service, and it's great to know that you're kind of there. But I heard about it easily, so promote it more.
So tell us about your daily routine then. What was the daily routine like?
It's a simple life out on the road. Because I wasn't doing any particular set mileage, or I didn't have to get particular places each day. It was quite relaxed. I didn't have a strict time I'd start, and I didn't have a strict time I'd finish. But in general, I would be walking by 7 a.m., mainly because it's been blowing a hooli all night, so I'm awake anyway. It's 24-hour daylight, so I'm awake anyway. So, yeah, my body clock just said it's easier just to be up and walking. I never was walking after that. A couple of times I was walking earlier just because the weather was, the storms were so bad, I just thought, oh, it's easier to walk through it than lay here. But, yeah, so 7 a.m. start. I'd usually walk a good couple of hours before I'd have breakfast. That's just a personal preference. I like to get moving before I eat something. And then I only had like 4 snack bars to last me through the day. I didn't actually have a lunch. So I didn't have kind of a proper lunch break, because if I did, then I'd probably get upset that I didn't have anything to eat in it. So I would just kind of have really few breaks. The longest break I'd have would usually be when it was warm enough to dry my tent. Most nights the tent outer has got wet, and then when I pack it up, it gets the inner wet. So I'd dry out my tent and I'd just air my sleeping bag in case that had got condensation moisture or anything. So they were two jobs I always had to do, and I always had to filter my water whenever I came across a stream, and that would take quite long. So I'd kind of make my breaks as and when there was something else to do, rather than have kind of designated breaks at certain times or anything like that. And yeah, generally walk probably till six-ish in the evening, but again, no real schedule. Just by then, I'd usually had enough of walking and kind of covered a good distance, but nothing was set. I mean, my distances varied from kind of a 30K, kind of easy day, right up to 50K. But on average, I'd do about a marathon a day.
Just noticed you filtering some water then. Did you feel you had to filter the water, or was it a better idea to filter the water all the way through?
So there's two types of rivers. There were crystal clear rivers, which was just a natural river from a spring. It would probably absolutely fine to drink that. And if I hadn't have been practiced at always filtering my water, I'm sure everyone else did it, just drunk it straight from the stream. It was crystal clear. The Icelandics drink it. It would be fine. But I'm so used to filtering it, just because you paid all this money to come on these trips. Just to get sick, I just don't think it's worth it for the few extra minutes it's going to take to put through my filter. So I just filter my water. Whereas the other rivers, which are glacier rivers, are really cloudy looking. They're absolutely full of grit that's come off the glacier. Whether they have bugs in or not, questionable, but the grit will make you sick. So if you drunk probably even half a litre of that cloudy water, you would know about it. So, but for me, it was just easier to do all my water. If I got water from somewhere and I was just boiling it straight for dinner, then I wouldn't, you know, if I was camped at a river and I was boiling it, then I wouldn't filter it if it was from a clear river. But
So how many hot meals did you have a day then?
One, just one.
Just the evening.
So I had fire pot evening meal. I have my food here. So I have one of these in the evening. Not sponsored by fire pot, but having tried pretty much every brand out there, personally, I think they're the one that tastes like real food. And they're a lovely brand, which is great ethics. So so I had one hot meal, and then for breakfast, I made my own these. So it's same amount of calories as in was in a fire pot meal, but it was just cheap to make your own. And then, yeah, just 4 snack bars kind of in the day, just a standard kind of a normal trekking bar snack. So I was pretty low on calories. I had just over 2,000 calories a day, whereas I was probably burning nearer 4,000. So I knew I was going to be in a calorie deficit throughout the journey. But it's a real balance of how much you're willing to carry to how much you're going to enjoy yourself, how much you're going to need the energy to be physically able to do it. Yeah, it's finding that kind of precious ground. And I knew with 2,000 calories, it wasn't going to make me feel, I was going to have enough energy to be able to do it. There are a few moments where I definitely would have liked more food, just from more from a boredom point of view. Like if I had lots of snacks throughout the day, it's something to do. But I never felt like I'd run out of oomph from a lack of food. So I think I got the amount spot on.
To see and hear more from Katie Jane Endurance, do go and check out the hour-long video, which is over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk and on YouTube. Plus, of course, all the social media links can be found there as well. Your feedback on this first video interview would be appreciated. Would you like to see more like this with people from around the world? More location visits, perhaps? Maybe gear discussions or general outdoor chit-chat from different perspectives? Of course, audio podcasts will still be released like this from each soundtrack, so all you commuters out there will not be forgotten. My thanks to Katie Jane, of course, for taking the time to chat and her patience while we overcame various technical difficulties. With podcast number 500 looming, I need to do something special. So your answers on a digital postcard, please. Just put them in the show notes. Until next time, folks, take care out there and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.